Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents When I Passed the Statue of Liberty, I Became Black, by Harry Edward. Edited by Neil Duncanson. Narrated by Amir Abdullah. Introduction. Neil Duncanson. Harry Edward had until now been forgotten. What robbed him of his rightful place in history was the simple combination of time, geographic displacement, and of course, the color of his skin. A few years ago, I was working on a new edition of a book about the men's Olympic 100-meter medal winners. This new edition would include brief sketches of all the Olympic medalists, not just the champions. I knew the name Harry Edward, but there wasn't much to go on, only a few entries in the record books. He'd won 2 medals in the sprint events at the 1920 Olympics, where he represented Great Britain. He was a 3-time national champion at the 100 and 220 yards. Harold Abrams, 1924, Olympic 100-meter champion and star of Chariots of Fire, described him as one of the greatest sprinters I ever saw. Then, Harry Edward vanished from view. There were none of the standard retrospectives, hardly a mention in any books of the time, no newspaper articles, and not a single obituary to rely on. My research took me in a surprising direction. Although he had won medals and titles for Britain, curiously, Harry Edward had been born in Berlin and spent most of his life in the United States. More digging led me to the Amistad Research Center in New Orleans, an independent repository for papers, books, and materials relating to African-American culture. All Harry Edward's papers were donated to the Amistad Center after his death. 9 large boxes contained scrapbooks and photographs, letters and documents, medals and certificates. But the greatest find was a complete typewritten memoir that Harry had finished in the early 1970s and had taken around the publishing houses of New York and London without success. One New York literary agent had been particularly blunt. "Dear Mr. Edward, you've led an interesting life, but I'm afraid the book doesn't seem, to me, too interesting. It just doesn't seem very lively. Perhaps part of this is due to so much of the book dealing with events in the past, and also to a great deal of detail which doesn't, at this time, seem very important." The manuscript sat untouched in its box for nearly 50 years, but the world changed around it, in ways that would have pleased and troubled Harry Edward. Today we can see that his memoir and perspective have tremendous value to all kinds of readers. Athletes are not known for their writing, but this is a compelling tale of an extraordinary life. Harry Edward was present at some of the most significant moments of the 20th century, and not just as a passive observer. Every chapter reveals an almost Zelig-like journey through wars, the Depression, the civil rights struggle, social upheaval, and international affairs. Harry Edward met kings and presidents, orphans and refugees. Immensely capable at everything he attempted, he worked alongside W.E.B. Du Bois and Orson Welles. He faced injustice and bigotry. He challenged prejudice and intolerance. He never backed down, and he never stopped. This text follows Harry Edward's final manuscript, but includes some additions from earlier versions of his memoir. 1. Discovery of America. It was on a beautiful August afternoon in the year 1923 when I discovered America. As the good ship RMS Franconia, 7 days out of Liverpool, sailed along the coast of Long Island, I, like many other passengers, filled out the various required government forms. I recall how a British fellow traveller at my side burst out in pretended indignation. "It's an outrage for Americans to call me, an Englishman, an alien." The ship came to a halt in the Narrows between Brooklyn and Staten Island and took aboard a group of immigration and health officers of the federal government. Slowly, the RMS Franconia steamed into the inner harbour and the Statue of Liberty came into view. It was then that I was called before the immigration officer. This conscientious official established that I was an alien, born in Germany, entering under the German immigration quota. That I had a valid British passport because I was born a British subject. That my vocational designation was clerk, because I had not completed the final portion of the professional examination of a British chartered society, akin to that of certified public accountants. The immigration official observed my dark complexion, curly hair, and recorded furthermore that I was a Negro. Thus it happened that I became black, a Negro, when passing the Statue of Liberty. The question of color had not affected me previously in any serious manner. I came to the United States in response to an invitation by a sports promoter to take part in the Wilco Games at the Yankee Stadium. In the preceding year, I had won 3 British track championships in one day, namely the Amateur Athletic Association's championships, open to all comers. These contests had preceded the modern cycle of the Olympic Games by more than a half century and were regarded as world championships. The AAA championships of 1922 had been honored by the visit of H.M. King George V. Thus, it happened that I was called before His Majesty and congratulated by him. This event was recorded on photographs and films which were distributed throughout the world, and especially in the United States, to the sports-conscious American press. Upon my setting foot on the soil of the United States of America, I learned very soon that among all the classifications given to me, the designation Negro was the most significant. On my visit to Paris the year before, I had been received at the airport by the Secretary of the International Athletic Association, a Deputy Minister of Health, and officials of the sponsoring club with their ladies. At New York, a clerk of the promoter perfunctorily sped me to the Harlem Young Men's Christian Association, which facilities proved to be quite a contrast to those of the Hotel Saint-Lazare in Paris. However, I had been toughened by my experiences as a prisoner of war. During World War I, I had spent 3 years and 8 months as a British prisoner of war in German prisons and in a German internment camp under exceedingly rough conditions. Therefore, the lack of many comforts did not disturb me particularly. From my base in the YMCA, I decided to discover Harlem, then hailed by the news media and in literature as the Mecca of the New Negro. And surely, I was a New Negro. Negro Harlem extended at that time approximately from 126th Street to 155th Street, from 5th Avenue in the east to 8th Avenue in the west. 135th Street was regarded as the center of Negro Harlem. Located there were the YMCA, the Negro newspapers, Negro physicians and lawyers, real estate operators, beauticians and undertakers. 125th Street was even then the uptown shopping center, having also several vaudeville, burlesque, and movie theaters. Businesses in that thoroughfare were exclusively in the hands of white merchants, organized in the lily-white Uptown Chamber of Commerce. In places of entertainment, with few exceptions, Negroes were directed to the balcony and barred from orchestra seats. In business establishments, they were effectively excluded from employment as sales personnel and confined to functions as porters and maintenance workers. Many Negroes lived south of 125th Street, as well as in the peripheral areas west and east, while many white residents, especially store owners, were interspersed throughout the area. However, at the time of my arrival, my eyes, ears, and mind were not attuned to racial differences, color, and color shadings. Thus, when I met light-skinned, fair-haired, blue-eyed Walter White, then Assistant Secretary of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, it took mental effort to comprehend and believe his proud claim of belonging to the Negro race. My initial introduction to the new and strange world which surrounded my monastery-like room at the YMCA was aided by Lieutenant Roy Morse of the 369th Infantry Regiment, himself a former track athlete. He was the son-in-law of the publisher of the New York Amsterdam News. In this manner, I met William Kelly, the paper's imaginative editor, Romeo L. Doherty, a feature writer on sports and theatrical events, and J. W. Roger, a writer known for his iconoclastic column From Superman to Man, an indefatigable researcher into racial myths. These gentlemen made possible my meeting a group of people regarded as leaders in Negro Harlem. Nail and Parker, Philip A. Payton, realtors, Alderman Fred Moore, owner of the New York Age, a weekly newspaper, Bojangles Robinson, who starred in a Negro Review, Charles Anderson, collector of internal revenue, assistant corporation counselor James Watson, Billboard Jackson, theatrical writer, George Harris, leader of Harlem's Republican Club, physicians E.P. Roberts and Ernest Anderson, whose wives gave loyal and devoted volunteer service to Harlem's Young Women's Christian Association. I was also honored to meet the hardworking and efficient secretaries of the two Harlem Ys, the YWCA and the YMCA, Mrs. Cecilia C. Saunders and Mr. Henry K. Kraft. In those early years on the American continent, I visited also some English members of my London Athletic Club, resident in New York City. They received me warmly, and one of them arranged my having a rented room on Upper Broadway, close to Columbia University's South Field, the athletic field then located south of 116th Street, opposite the Low Library. There, I had the visits of photographers and sports writers whose professional products appeared in stories published in the New York Herald, the New York Times, the World, the Sun, and the Globe, the Evening World, the Home News. New York City had many newspapers then, announcing my appearance at the Yankee Stadium track meet. My name had been entered in the 100 yards, the furlong, and the quarter-mile races, over which distances I had won the AAA Open World Championships the preceding year. However, I failed to land among the first three in any of those events. On this, my first appearance in America. Nevertheless, other invitations were extended to me to take part in athletic competitions organized by the New York Athletic Club and the Boston Athletic Club in the fall of 1923. When traveling to Boston by means of the Old Dominion line via Providence, Rhode Island, I remember reading an article on the heavyweight boxing championship fight between Luis Angel, Firpo, and Jack Dempsey, held at the Polo Grounds, with 20,000 fans in the stands. I was astonished. True, in August I had suffered from the unaccustomed humid heat of New York City, but I could not imagine that an outdoor event attracted so many fans. It took a little time to get used to American English, especially the sports headlines of the New York Daily News, as, for instance, Yanks socks split before 25,000. Lifts became elevators. Petrol, gas. Trolleys, streetcars. A bowler hat was called a derby. I had such a hat in those days, as well as a Macintosh, a British raincoat. Thus attired, I presented myself to several businessmen of New York City to whom I submitted letters of reference given me by well-known London merchants. I was job hunting with vigor for a clerical position, but to no avail. 2. Searching for a job. Friends referred me to the office of the National Urban League, whose staff consisted of Eugene Kinkle Jones as executive secretary and six clerical assistants. They urged my seeing attorney L. Hollingsworth Wood, founder and president of the National Urban League. It was a heartwarming experience to meet and talk to this cheerful and forthright Quaker, who had made the right of the American Negro to equal economic opportunities his life's work. After listening to the story of my business experiences in Europe, he asked me to accompany him for the purpose of visiting some friends in their Wall Street offices. He presented me to them with a flowery description of my studies and accomplishments and asked them to provide a job opportunity for me. In one instance, a director of an insurance company threw up his hands and exclaimed, "Impossible!" Others accepted the request with calm. In one instance, a prominent coffee importer offered me a possible job in Brazil. I felt forever grateful to L. Hollingsworth Wood for this tangible evidence of his Christian commitment. 2 years later, I met him again in Philadelphia at a conference of the Urban League. Hard at work with his usual cheerfulness and zest, I asked him whether he did not grow tired and discouraged at times. He replied, "Oh, my dear Mr. Edward, this is the greatest joy of my life!" When relating this story to friends who had worked closely with him, they assured me that the remark was a true reflection of his inner feelings. The memory of the words and deeds of L. Hollingsworth Wood and of a few other white Americans were often the soothing balm on so many wounds inflicted by the bigotry in American society. I learned that the renowned Wanamaker store promoted annually the Milrose Indoor Track Meeting, held at Madison Square Garden, then located on the site of the present New York Life Insurance office building near Madison Square. This meeting, I was told, always had a strong representation of Negro athletes, staff members of Wanamaker's department store. In my job search, I presented myself to the personnel director of Wanamaker's. He listened politely to the recitation of my qualifications and told me in a matter-of-fact voice that he could offer me only a job as elevator operator or porter. While searching through the male help wanted columns of the New York Times, I spotted a vacancy which called for skills which I was able to offer with the utmost of confidence, skills which I had used successfully in a job in London. The advertisement read, "German and French correspondent for import and export house, typing required." There were no restrictions listed, such as white or colored, or under 40, customary in those days. Promptly, I presented myself to the fee-charging employment agency, submitted my credentials, which included English, French, and German shorthand, and requested a referral for an interview with the employer. The employment agent gazed at me for a moment and said in a somewhat bombastic manner, "Oh, I am sorry, but I am looking for a typical American boy." All my pleas for a tryout fell on the deaf ears of a prejudiced mind. Footsore and soul sore, I began to realize that the doors to office jobs were closed to me. I became painfully aware that my meager finances were rapidly declining. There was no income, and living expenses were relatively high with my room on Broadway and food taken in restaurants. I discussed my plight with a young lady from British Demerara, now Guyana, who had opened a job placement agency on 6th Avenue, near 46th Street, where scores of job agencies were situated. "Harry," she said, "you are too damned honest," she continued. "If you want a job," and we were discussing manual labor, "you must learn to tell them you have experience." She gave me the address of a small restaurant in the Garment District where a vacancy existed for a dishwasher. In addition, she handed me a list of three restaurants she knew for their high labor turnover. I walked briskly to the restaurant and asked for the boss. He came from behind the counter and motioned to me to sit at one of the dozen tables where he joined me. He asked me whether I had experience as a dishwasher, and with a voice ringing full of confidence and conviction, I said, "Sure I have." Then he queried, "Where?" Frankly, I had forgotten the names of the places where I was supposed to have worked. Without being flustered in the least, I drew out of my pocket the slip with the names of my alleged former employees and read them to the boss. It seemed he was not measuring my IQ because he said I could start the next day. He showed me the kitchen, a narrow space behind a wooden partition, the tubs and the boxes of soap powder. I was there the next morning at the appointed time, put on my apron, got acquainted with the short order cook, and learned from him the routine of the place. The rush period was, of course, lunchtime. I washed most conscientiously the constant flow of dishes, cups, and saucers, washed them in hot water with lots of soap powder. I believed I was a good dishwasher. However, after a week, my hands became painfully sore as the soap powder seemingly ate away my fingernails. I reduced the quantity of soap, but then the boss complained once or twice that the plates were not sufficiently shiny. Anyhow, I had something to eat, free of charge, so I ate. It seemed that I consumed too many sandwiches and pies for the boss's liking, because after 10 days, he paid me off. Then I heard that the docks paid well for longshoremen work. 53 cents per hour for longshoremen and 49 cents per hour for truckmen, with overtime at the rate of time and a half after 8 hours of work. Dock workers were not unionized at that time. I went to the docks dressed as usual in my British raincoat and derby, and told the boss at the hiring office that an employment agency had sent me. He said that I should not pay a cent to any employment office, that he and he alone was the hiring boss. He instructed me to come back at 6 p.m. for the shape-up. The shape-up was the usual hiring method in those days at the docks, as well as at the entrance gates of factories. The men seeking work would form a semicircle, and the boss facing them would pick those he wanted. That evening, the hiring boss at the dock called the low-numbered crews of 8 who had worked the previous night. Then new crews were made up and higher numbers given them. The number of crews depended on the volume of work to be handled. Each crew consisted of 4 longshoremen and 4 truckmen. 2 longshoremen would be stationed in the rail car, on the floating barge, and 2 at the designated space on the dock. The former would load the crates of fruit or vegetables onto hand trucks, which the truckmen would trundle to the docks. There, the 2 longshoremen would stack the crates by lot numbers. Circulating among the crews were pushers, who would push the men to maximum effort and speed. At the shape-up, the hiring boss had spotted me in my derby and English raincoat and had hired me. He asked me whether I was a longshoreman or a truckman. I replied promptly that I was a longshoreman, having in mind the higher rate of pay. However, I soon learned that longshoremen worked almost continuously stacking those 50-pound crates, sometimes 6 feet high, while the truckmen could often lean on their hand trucks and rest. My muscles became very tired and sore after 10 or 11 hours of slinging crates, so that I decided on my first night that I would henceforth be an experienced truckman. There were other adventures during the early days of my discovery of America. For 2 weeks, I worked as a laborer on a construction job in Brooklyn, several times as a car washer in Brooklyn garages. My first job as a car washer was an ordeal. Having developed a boldness in claiming broad experience, I had assured the garage owner that I could wash and drive cars. In reality, I had never driven a car, so I had to learn to drive that very afternoon. Lieutenant Roy Morse had a car, and he was kind enough to take me to the Harlem Speedway and teach me for 1 hour. First, he drew a capital H on a paper and explained the standard gear shift with its first, second, high gear, and reverse positions. Then, he explained how to turn the ignition key, keeping the gear in neutral, and to give gas, how to release the accelerator, shifting to first, then step up gas, release the shift to second, give gas again, and shift to third in high gear and accelerate. Well, I did drive the car over a short distance, perspiring under great nervous strain. That afternoon, I learned by heart the procedure. When riding the subway to my new Brooklyn job, I repeated over and over again. Put gear shift in neutral, turn on ignition, give her gas, reduce gas. Shift to first, give her gas, reduce gas. Shift to second, give her gas, reduce. Shift to third, give her gas. I thought I knew it. However, on the job, when wishing to put the first car from its parking space onto the washstand, the car refused to move, yet I had followed all the instructions. The boss came over and asked what the trouble was. I said naively, "It does not move." He looked inside and said, "Why don't you release the handbrake?" How was I to know? Nobody had told me. At about midnight, many customers arrived from their parties and theater shows and left their cars in the passage until they spilled over into the entrance and the street. I had to park them somehow to keep the entrance clear. Oh, how I did sweat that night, handling cars of all makes and trying to get them into their narrow spaces. I cannot remember how many cars I washed, but it was an exhausting experience. I lasted 2 nights on that job. There were other car washing jobs, but on my last job as a washer, I was so efficient and well thought of by the boss that he assured me on my leaving I could get my job back any time I wanted. However, I had procured a steady job. namely as a porter at the Aeolian Hall, one of the foremost concert halls of New York City. As a fringe benefit to my menial occupation, I could listen to the New York Philharmonic and numerous instrumental and vocal concert artists. Thus, it happened that I was present when George Gershwin and Paul Whiteman's band gave the original performance of Rhapsody in Blue, this broody instrumental composition, irregular in form, like an improvisation. It was so much like my struggles since passing the Statue of Liberty, irregular in form, like an improvisation and in a blue mood. To stay or not to stay this side of the Statue of Liberty, that was the question, a question turned over in my mind numerous times. In London, England, I had been a cost accountant and French and German correspondent with merchants and manufacturing concerns. In Great Britain, I was known to the sports fraternity as a 7-times track champion who had captained many teams on goodwill tours on the European continent. In 1921 and in 1922, I had been honored with the Best Athlete of the Year award, and the Polytechnic Institute had inscribed my name in marble on the honor list of members who had made valued contributions to the school in sports or scholarships. From Europe, I had viewed the United States of America as the land of hope for the peace of the world. President Wilson's 14 points had stirred great hopes in the hearts of a large segment of mankind touched by World War I. The war to make the world safe for democracy. The prominence in sports that I had gained enabled me to participate in many concrete expressions of the Peace Corps idealism of that period, when youth sought to reach out to youth of other lands. In those days, too, there was a generation gap. The older generation longed for the peaceful good old days. And the political slogan expressing that sentiment was, both in Great Britain and in the United States, back to normalcy. An American song of that period also sketched the divergent pulls of the post-war days. How you going to keep 'em down on the farm after they've seen Paris? I was reading voraciously in those days, both large morning newspapers of New York City, namely the New York Times and the New York World, 2 cents per copy. I made a valiant effort to understand my environment and the problems of the day. And there were many problems. In the U.S. Senate, Senators Norris, Wagner, Walsh, and La Follette were thundering against the unrestrained manipulations of capitalists grown richer and more powerful by accumulated war profits. The Teapot Dome revelations of uncompetitive tendering disclosed how graft and corruption had reached into the president's cabinet. Senator Cotton Tom Heflin of Alabama was the champion of white supremacy of the rural South and a violent and virulent anti-Catholic crusader. The night riders of the Ku Klux Klan were burning crosses, flogging, and killing those of whom they did not approve. They exerted themselves also politically, capturing some city halls and state houses. In the Pennsylvania coal fields, open warfare raged between the United Mine Workers of America, led by John L. Lewis, and the armed private coal and iron police of the mine owners. The civil right of workers to join a union was then still 11 years in the future. Of those days of prohibition, bootleggers and their syndicates corrupted many phases of public life, and their methods were even more ruthless than those of the mafia today. My endeavor was to evaluate life in America with all the mentioned problems against life in Europe, with its destructive nationalism and long history of wars. Into these considerations entered also the seeming American economic success stories of some of my friends from Great Britain, France, and the West Indies. There is no doubt that I underrated considerably the pervasiveness and depth of America's racial factor, in spite of my harsh experiences. I had to decide whether to ask my wife and 14-year-old stepson to join me in accordance with our original plans, or whether I should return to Great Britain, admitting that my plans had been a failure. My wife was, however, anxious to join me, in spite of my evident inability to offer her an adequately secure economic base. She was a very talented dressmaker and hoped to supplement the family income. It was my good fortune to find and rent an upper-floor apartment in a conveniently located private house in Brooklyn, which I furnished with second-hand furniture. The landlord living on the premises was a congenial English family who had heard and read about my exploits on British cinder tracks. The arrival of my wife and son was a happy occasion, but clouded by the thought that their passports carried only a
sample complete. Ready to continue?